Yeah.
I felt, this thing's not really connected, so I think I can, well, it's not even plugged into it, so I can move it over next to it. So it has been a good 2 days here, and probably most of you don't know this, but University of Chicago is an awesome center. It has been for probably 50 years, and it's a great thing to come here and visit and give a talk, and then talk with many faculty members, some of whom I've known for many years, and others got to know more recently. And actually, this crowd here, there are some I've known for quite a few years, and some I've wanted to meet for a long time, like Professor John Subby from Princeton, and Professor Ian Hutchinson from MIT. I wanted to meet the two of them. We had breakfast this morning, so that goal has been ticked off. Been done. I know who these guys are. You know, singing this hymn, I have to tell you something about Holy, Holy, Holy. I've liked this hymn since I became a Christian as a young professor at Berkeley. But it's taken on much more personal meaning. For about the last 10 years, I had just an opportunity of a lifetime, 10 years ago, to go with my wife and family to Australia, where I was on staff, and to stop off in the South Pacific for 10 days along the way. And so we went to church, and it was over Christmas. We went to church in Rarotonga, we went to church in Aitutaki, and we went to church in Kororoa. And by the time this was done, I really had the drill. Because every church, these churches were all started by the London Missionary Society 200 years ago, and every church service starts the same. 60 minutes, so we know what that means. You're just growing up, Jeff, but you know, you got to get you around the block a few times. This is where we work. This is the Center for Computational Chemistry at the University of Georgia. Some of you have visited us here, and we would certainly invite all the rest to come and see us. It's a building that's about 8 years old, and a great place to work. And here are the members of my research institute, or some of the members of my research institute, because at least some of these don't work for me. For example, my wife thinks me would not want anyone to think that she works for me. She's an elementary school teacher and a great one as well. But I will say this. I am the MIT nerd who married the homecoming queen. I will say that. So, yeah, it shocked all my high school classmates that she would have any interest in me, but, you know, it worked out all right. So, anyway, now there's one other person here. There's somebody obviously here who looks very distinguished, okay? And you have to know who that is. That is a distinguished person. Now, I don't, you know, talking in physics on Tuesday, they don't have a football team here at the University of Chicago. They haven't had it for a long time. And I told them that they were football fans. They would immediately recognize this photograph. Vince Doolin, the legendary coach of the University of Georgia Bulldogs, member of the Hall of Fame, and so on and so forth. Now, you might ask, what is Vince Dooley doing in this picture of the members of the Center for Computational Chemistry? Well, the building I showed you on the previous slide, the Athletic Association, namely Vince, contributed $3 million for him. So we feel very positive about football. And those of you that follow football know that it has been a rough season. The football coach, Mark Rick, lives right around the corner from me, and you know, so don't even dare go outside anymore. So what is this? What's this conference about? I think this conference is about. We'll find out as time goes on. I think this conference is about worldview. Here's one attempt to define a worldview, and I'm sure everybody in this room would have a different definition, but here's one. Each individual has his or her own experiences, and out of them forms his or her own worldview. Carefully thought out worldview reflects the deep hunger among human beings for an overarching framework to bring unity to their lives. And, you know, when we see a headline on Time magazine that says science versus God, it does make us a little bit uncomfortable, you know, because we would like to have a single view of the universe. You know, we would like to believe, and I do, that the fabric of knowledge is seamless. So we want to have a worldview, and everybody has one. And most everybody wants to have one. Well, My topic this morning is kind of related to the question which I heard many times as an undergraduate and as a graduate student, you know, is it possible for a scientist to be a Christian? But I want to step back from that for a little bit and say something about the interaction of science with other intellectual pursuits. And I want to focus on two, one, literature, and secondly, philosophy. I want to quote from this book, which I think is quite good. It's called Literature by Susan Gallagher and Richard Lundeen, and some of you probably know both of these people. But they talk about this in their book on literature. Let me quote from them. They say, because in recent history, literature has often found itself in opposition to science. To understand modern views about literature, we must recognize the dominance of science in our culture. For several centuries, the sciences have set the standards of truth for Western culture, and their undeniable usefulness in helping us to organize, analyze, and manipulate facts has given them an unprecedented importance in modern society. So there is a relationship, but it's been a rocky relationship at times. Let me say that. Let me give you one example. In fact, when I go over to the English department occasionally, you know, we have discussions. Heated discussions sometimes. Just one of the examples that Gallagher and Lundeen give is this poem by Keats, which many are familiar with. It's called Lae Mia, and I'm told that is the correct pronunciation. And it's about science. Well, at least the poem includes things about science in it. But Keats calls science philosophy. Okay, philosophy. So I'm going to spoil the meter of this poem if it has any, and just say science when Keats says philosophy. Do not old terms fly at the mere touch of cold science? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. We knew her woo for texture. She was given in the dull catalog common things. Science will flip an angel's wings, conquer all mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air and no mind unweave a rainbow. So some tension between science and literature. Let's take an example from philosophy. Is Alan planning on going to be here?
You're not here.
Right. Okay. Now I don't. You're not going to. You probably. Let me say. I want to be cautious here. I want to say I was a faculty colleague with Byron for 18 years at Berkeley, and I never met him. Is it fair to say he was an eccentric individual?
Yeah, I mean,
we want to be charitable to the greatest degree possible. I guess I could add that not very many of his other faculty colleagues knew him as well. But he was at Berkeley for a long time, and I think many would say that he was one of the greatest of philosophers of the 20th century. And he thought there was a conflict between science and philosophy. And so let me just share from something that he's written, which is interesting. So this is from Feyerabend. It's the rise of modern science coincides with the suppression of non-Western tribes by Western invaders. And it's sort of familiar language. The tribes are not only physically suppressed, they also lose their intellectual independence and are forced to adopt the bloodthirsty religion of brotherly love, Christianity. Let me tell you this, you know, these folks that we visited for 10 days in the South Pacific, they did adopt Christianity, and they stopped killing each other, and visitors too, more importantly. So I'm not going to, I'm not giving any credence to this statement by Feyerabend. I'm just presenting it for what it is. It says, today this development is gradually reversed, and he likes that, isn't it? But science still reigns supreme, and he doesn't like that. In fact, he has this conjunction between science and Christianity. These are his two great enemies. Thus, while Americans can now choose the religion he likes, he's still not permitted to demand that his children learn magic rather than science. He's serious about it. Yeah, you know, you're laughing, but he's serious. And yet science has no greater authority than any other form of life. So I hope that Professor Planning maybe will give a different view of the universe than that. But in any case, There has been conflict between science and virtually every other intellectual endeavor. And some of the conflict arises, to take some blame for science because of what we might call scientific imperialism. And that is to say that the Richard Dawkins sort of stuff, that science is everything and all that. This has been discussed for at least a century, and I want to quote Erwin Schrödinger, author of The Most Important Equation in Science, the Schrödinger Equation. And he wrote a little book for Cambridge University Press in 1954 called Nature and the Greeks. This is a good book. You'll get this and read it. And he presents what I think is quite a balanced view, not to say that his worldview is the same as mine, because it wasn't. But I think he does a good job on this. He says, I'm very astonished that the scientific picture of the real world is very deficient. It gives a lot of factual information, puts all our experience in a magnificently consistent order, but it is ghastly silent about all that is really near to our hearts, all that really matters to us. Cannot tell us a word about red and blue, bitter and sweet, physical pain and physical delight. It knows nothing of beautiful and ugly, good or bad, God and eternity. This is the point. It says science sometimes pretends to answer such questions, but the answers are often so silly that we are not inclined to take them seriously. So that's a balance statement, I think. Now, scientists and their gods. Is that the title that was used for this talk? Was any title enough for this talk?
You actually do put up titles.
Okay.
In case people change them.
Yeah, so this is great. I wrote whatever I want. The title of this talk was supposed to be Scientists and Their Gods. So we want to try to be ecumenical here and include a number of viewpoints. So I'll take two. One has special connection to the University of Chicago. But the first example, is going to be Lev Landau. Lev Landau received the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1962 for work on liquid helium. And certainly the most brilliant Soviet physicist of the 20th century. And quite a acerbic personality. But let me tell you a story that appeared in Physics Today. Physics Today is perhaps the Time magazine of the physics community. This appeared in Physics Today, written by his close friend, Kolotnikov. And this is a story about the end of his life. Kolotnikov says, the last time I saw Landau was in 1968, after he'd had an operation. His health had greatly deteriorated. Lifshitz and I, Landau wrote many books with Lifshitz, and older people will know. Lifshitz and I were summoned by the hospital. We were informed there was practically no chance that he could be saved. When I entered his ward, Landau was lying at his side, his face turned to the wall. He heard my steps, turned his head, and said, Kolot, please save me. These were the last words I heard from Landau. He died that night. These stories are kind of discouraging, so we don't want to tell too many of them. But the second one is a story. It's not a story. It's an interview of Chandrasekhar. Chandrasekhar, great Indian-born astrophysicist, but spent most of his life here at the University of Chicago. Got the Nobel Prize in 1983. Just a towering intellect. Editor of the Astrophysical Journal from here in Chicago for many years. I sent him a few papers. I'm happy to say he accepted them all. His biographer is a person named Wally, who has published this biography a bit more than 15 years ago. Yeah, Chandrasekhar has been gone for a while. The book is good, and I recommend it to anyone who's interested in the history of science. It's an excellent book. But it's interesting that all the reviews of this book all focus, laser-like, on an interview at the end of the book. And so let me share this with you. It's pretty interesting. This is the interview between Wally, the author of the biography, and Chandrasekhar. Chandrasekhar says, in fact, I consider myself an atheist, but I have a feeling of disappointment because the hope for contentment and a peaceful outlook on life
as a result of pursuing a goal has remained unfulfilled. And you, everybody here will know that these are the, at least two of the great goals of the East. He's looked on life and contentment. So he says he's not completely happy. And his biographer seems to be surprised, which is a little surprising to me since he's been writing about it for 300 pages before he does his interview. But he says, I don't get it.
Yeah, you mean single-minded pursuit of science, understanding parts of nature and comprehending nature with such enormous success still leaves you with a feeling of discontentment.
And Chandrasekhar says, no, I don't really have a sense of
fulfillment. All I've done seems to be not very much.
And now his biographer is going to lighten the tempo of this. This is really getting way too heavy. But don't you think everybody's got the same problem? And Chandrasekhar is not giving ground. He says, well, it may be, but the fact that other people experience it doesn't change the fact that one is experiencing it. It doesn't become less personal on that account. And this is, I'm going to show you his last statement, which I think is something for anybody who wants to go into science, actually anybody who wants to go into any field, to think hard about. Chandrasekhar concludes, what is true for my own personal case is that I simply don't have that sense of harmony which I'd hoped for when I was young, and I've persevered in science for over 50 years. The time I've devoted to other things is minuscule. Jeff and I have been talking about this. What it takes to become a chemistry or a physics professor, you know, is it 40 hours a week, 60, 80, 100, 120? You know, depends on the person. Yeah, this is something to think about. You know, so I think what he's saying, the rest of you can assess this as well, is that he didn't really get a satisfactory worldview out of science. That's the easiest way to understand this. Well, so there are scientists who are atheists. Lev Landau was one. Chandrasekhar was one. And there are plenty of others. Richard Dawkins of Time Magazine this week. This feeling is a bit contagious. C.S. Lewis talked about how this was contagious in his autobiography of his early life, Surprised by Joy, a great book. He says, you understand that my atheism was inevitably based on what I believe to be the findings of the sciences. Some scientist, or somebody who said he knew all about science, said science had disproved God. Those findings, not being a scientist, I had to take on trust and back on authority. So somebody told him science had disproved God, and I think it's probably some C.S. Lewis scholarship. I don't think Lewis ever took a single course on science, in the sciences at all. So he had to take somebody's word for it. First 30 years of his life, he was, I shouldn't say the first 30 years. Between ages 10 and 30, he was an atheist. All right, now time is going by here, and I have to be careful. Let me just share this thing by Richard Feynman. Richard Feynman, I think most of you know, probably the greatest physicist from in the middle third of the 20th century, outspoken atheist. He didn't go to his father's memorial service because it was presided over by a rabbi. But still, in this essay he wrote 9 years before he got the Nobel Prize, he says, many scientists do believe in both sides of God, the God of Revelation, in a perfectly consistent way. So is it possible to be a scientist and a Christian? Certainly it is. I'm going to leave out C.P. Snow here. It's too bad. Let me quote, I love this quotation from Alan Lightman. I bet you know Alan Lightman, don't you? A little bit, yeah. Yeah, you know, a lot of faculty members at MIT. I like this statement by Lightman, and he has published a neat book called Origin, the Lives and Worlds of Modern Cosmology. He took the Dan Rather approach to this problem, got himself a tape recorder, traveled all around the world and asked these great scientists ultimate questions. What is life? Is there meaning in the universe? Does God exist? Is there life after death? All these ultimate questions, and I don't have time enough. They said, indeed, contrary, popular that scientists appear to have the same range of attitudes about religious matters as does the general public. Statistical surveys, polls show the same thing. Okay? Now, I do want to quote from Michael Plunge. Yeah, I do. Don't I, Alice? I do want it. I do. Don't I? I think I do. Yeah, I do, definitely. I do. Let me quote from Polanyi. One of the reasons I like to quote from Polanyi is because he was a physical chemist, the most noble of all professions, I'm sure everybody knows. Art, isn't that right? Yeah. Yeah, is that right? Reason with your name. Yeah. Okay. Polanyi was not just a good physical chemist, like C.P. Snow was a good physical chemist. He was a great physical chemist. And I think many of you will know that he his life is interesting. Yeah. Polanyi's life is quite interesting. He at the age of 28 he joined the Roman Catholic Church. He was, of course, I think most of you know, grew up in a Jewish family in Budapest. And maybe 12, 15 years later, he really adopted a Protestant Christian perspective on life. And I think this is from Personal Knowledge, which is a good book of his. He says, I shall re-examine him the suppositions underlying our belief in science. I showed this slide at the ETH Zurich, and my friend Richard Ernst, who got the Nobel Prize a few years ago, just almost went into a state of apoplexy. He says, there's nothing to believe in science. I said, Richard, you need to think more clearly about this. And do you believe in the scientific method? Stutter, 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 yeah. I think among So, and we like Polanyi because he was a scientist. I propose to show, therefore, an extensive and interesting thought. It will appear to coextend with the entire spiritual foundation of man and the very root of his social existence. Hence, I will urge our belief in science should be regarded as a token of much wider convictions. Now, I want to ask the question several times, why might a scientist become a Christian? Because I did during my fourth year as a professor at Berkeley, and I want to bring forth Eugene Wigner. Wigner has written his autobiography. He's gone now, but he wrote a pretty good autobiography. It's an interesting biography. He's obviously not a scholar of language, but I like this statement by him. Wigner, Nobel Prize, long time ago, maybe 1940. Likes to talk about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. Now, this depends on your audience, I have to say, because I have had people tell me that they found mathematics to be very ineffective. They'd never taken a mathematics exam in which they'd received an A, and they really thought mathematics was, you couldn't say it was effective. Well, for Wigner, it was effective. I guarantee you, if you've read his group theory book, you know that. And Wigner said, the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift that we neither understand nor deserve. And of course, it's an intriguing statement. Wigner, some of you may know, wandered into Protestantism of a sort. And in his autobiography, he said that, except for Edward Teller, none of my friends nowadays are Jewish. When we talk about a wonderful gift, I mean, if language means anything, you want to ask the question, who did the giving? So, can a scientist become a Christian? And answer number one from mathematical physics, the comprehensibility of the universe points to a sovereign creator God. Let me say just a little bit more. I have a long quotation from Keith Ward. Have you met Keith Ward yet, Art? Yeah, I have a long quotation from Keith Ward, but it won't fit in the time Jeff has given me, so this is my summary. The laws of nature look just as if they've been selected as the most simple and elegant principles of understandable change by a wise creator. Belief in the intelligibility of nature strongly suggests the existence of a cosmic mind who can construct nature in accordance with rational laws. And this is a great quotation from Keith Ward, but we're not going to get it. Let me quote from Robert Clark a little bit. He's written a little book. This is probably 30 years ago called Christian Belief in Science. He was a Cambridge academic some number of years ago. And let's start out this, and I'm not going to say too much about this, but maybe just a little bit. He says,
However, we may interpret the fact scientific development has only occurred in the Christian culture. I'm going to change that immediately and say sustained scientific development has only occurred in the Christian culture. Since ancients had brains as good as our own. Ancient Babylon, Egypt, Greece, India, Rome, China, accident, and so on. Science developed to a certain point and then stopped. And then he says why he thinks that's true. But I have better reasons for understanding why that's true. So that's all the time we're going to give him. Okay. Now, yeah, I'm going to do a better job. I hope. I hope I will. Yeah. Oh, should I say something about Bernard Lewis? You know Bernard Lewis at Princeton? Yeah. Let me tell you a story. This is, you know, he's written this book that sold a lot of copies called What Went Wrong. Are any of you familiar with this book? Yeah, written a lot of, this has sold a lot of copies. And let me just share this briefly because I think he does provide some of the explanation for why sustained scientific development didn't occur outside of Christendom. He tells this story. Maybe I'll read this. No, I won't. Print's too small. He talks about how the inability of science to continue under Islam is illustrated by the Great Observatory, built in the Galata district of Istanbul in 1577. You know, this is contemporary with Tycho Brahe. Tycho Brahe, remember the guy with the gold nose? I hope you all learned that in middle school science. He did have a gold nose. And when it was dug up, it wasn't there. So between death and burial, somebody stole the notes. This is pretty serious business. Lewis talks about this observatory in Istanbul. It raised to the ground by at least four Turkish troops by the order of the Sultan on the recommendation of the chief Mufti. And I can't confirm this myself, but Bernard Lewis claims that for the next 300 years there was no modern observatory in the Islamic world. It was too fresh. Now, if I had more time, when I lecture on this topic to honors freshman seminar in Georgia, and it takes 3 hours, but if I had more time, I'd talk about all these people. But I think Ian Hutchinson is going to talk about some. Are you going to talk about some of these people?
A little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to, I'm going to skip all the ones who are. Well, I'm not going to skip all the ones that are dead. Most of the ones who are dead, I'm going to skip. Most of these people on the left-hand side. I'm going to talk a little bit about the ones on the right-hand side and embarrass one of the people who's here in the audience. I'm going to give one example. I can't resist. I'm going to give an example from Michael Faraday. Michael Faraday, I think, universally recognized as the greatest experimental scientist of all time. And here are a few of the things he did. And a great history as a person, too. His father was a bootblack, and he had no formal education. My friend John Thomas, you know John Thomas, aren't you? Sure. Sir John Thomas, let me say. Yeah, that's pretty impressive, isn't it? You know, one of the good things about getting old is you meet a few sirs. You know, Sir Alan Batterby, Sir John Pole. Well, I know about it, but it's sad though because the sirs they tend to die off pretty early. And they become sir, they're about 1 foot in the grave. Anyway, Sir John Thomas is now about 75, and he wrote in 1991. There was a big Faraday thing in London, 200th year of his birth, and a lot of stuff going on. And John Thomas wrote a wonderful article in Chemistry in Britain about Faraday, and he made the outrageous claim that if Faraday had lived into the Nobel Prize era, another 50 years, he would have been deserving of no less than 8 different Nobel Prizes. Now, that's probably over the top a bit, but it does give you a sense of his accomplishments. And this is a story that perhaps you'll connect with the other two stories that I told, that Landau and Descartes. Faraday had a terminal illness, and a friend came to his bedside and said, "Sir Michael, what speculation do you have now?" And you know, when you're around people who are dying, unfortunately, I haven't done too much of that yet. The most natural thing in the world is to do anything to lighten the atmosphere, and that's what
this friend of Faraday's things, sort of like what speculations you have now. Because Faraday's whole scientific career was a matter of making a speculation, designing an experiment to test the speculation, going into the laboratory, doing the experiment, and find out. And Faraday was so creative that even if his speculations were wrong, the results were interesting. And Faraday's response is this. I wish I'd been there so I could get the exact intonation, but he said, speculation, man, I have none, I have certainties. I'm glad I don't rest my dying head upon speculation, for I know whom I believe, and I'm persuaded that he's able to keep that which I committed unto him against that day. And one of the times I gave an earlier version of this talk, there was somebody sitting right about where Dave Fisher is, young person, about 20 years old. He jumped up at this point in the lecture. I mean, that's unusual. Usually when they jump up, they're not on your side. He jumped up and said, oh, I'm so glad to know that Michael Faraday said that. I've heard it before, and I always wonder where it came from. I almost didn't tell him that the Apostle Paul had said this somewhere. I had to tell the truth. Okay, so I'm leaving all the rest of the stuff for Professor Hutchinson. Yeah, well, I've got to show you this. This is just so good. You know, the people that write biographies of these people are not all sympathetic. This guy, Jan Straubman, wrote a biography of Faraday and Maxwell. He didn't think anything about their religious views. But he pays them sort of a backhanded compliment. He says, the religious decisions of Faraday and Maxwell were inelegant, but effective invasions of social problems that distracted and destroyed the qualities of the works of many of their ablest contemporaries. If you read the rest, before and after this, what he means is that he thinks, Crowley thinks, there were a lot of people in England of comparable intellectual capabilities to Faraday and Maxwell, but he talks about how at the first flush of success, they became alcoholics, womanizers, and social climbers, and destroyed their careers. So, yeah, being a Christian is a good way to have a long scientific career. I'm skipping all this stuff. I'm skipping great things. It's painful to see it go. Let me just say this. Some people, and I've been asked this a number of times, are inclined to say, but everybody was a Christian back then. You know, it's hardly surprising that all these rates of science, because everybody was a Christian back then. But let me give you a list of other important intellectuals in this period who were not Christians, either atheists, agnostic, or deists. Thoreau, Emerson, Hobbes, Voltaire, Rousseau, Hume, Kant, Spinoza, Hegel, Nietzsche, Bentham, Feuerbach. In other intellectual pursuits, people were certainly not all Christians, and people were not all Christians in science departments either. So I think we can answer that criticism. Okay, well, now I'm going to talk about people I've known. Okay, I'm going to leave the others behind and talk about people I've known. Charles Poulsen is the first. I met him at a conference at the University of British Columbia, 1971. I think probably would have gotten a Nobel Prize in chemistry, but he failed one of the requirements, which is to be at least 65 years old, and died at 64. I'm sure he's not regretting it the least bit. He was a Methodist lay minister, a spokesman for Christians in academic science, and his friend Simon Altman, who was a different worldview, in his biographical memoir of the Royal Society of Poulsen, takes this from Poulsen. He says, describing his conversion to faith in Jesus Christ in 1930 at Cambridge, there were some 10 of us, and together we sought God, and together we found Him. I learned for the first time in my life that God was my friend. God became real to me, utterly real. I knew that I could talk to Him as I'd never imagined it possible before. And these prayers were the most glorious moment of the day. Life had a purpose, and that purpose colored everything. And my own experience is somewhat similar to that. Bob Griffiths is a distinguished professor at Carnegie Mellon University, recipient of one of the most distinguished awards in mathematical physics from the American Physical Society for his contributions to statistical mechanics and thermodynamics. These are getting pretty close to quantum chemistry, so we are fellow travelers, you might say. In physics today, when they announced his award, they put something in there which doesn't usually appear in physics today. Physics Today is sort of the Time magazine of the physics community. It says that an evangelical Christian, Griffith, also an amateur theologian, and helps teach a course on Christianity and science. Then, a couple years later, Bob Griffith made this comment, I think it was to Christianity Today. He said, if you need an atheist for debate, I go to the philosophy department. The physics department isn't much use. In our university, I go to the religion department. Nobody's here from the divinity school. And even if they are, they probably don't know anybody at the University of Georgia. Richard Hume, I could talk about, but I'm not going to say too much. Certainly, long-time editor of the Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation, distinguished career in material science, chairman of his department at Stanford University for many years, work on photoelectronic properties of materials, wrote the classic text on solar cells. He picked up on Bob Griffith's comment, when I need an atheist, I can't get much help in the physics department. He said this: there are proportionately as many atheist truck drivers as atheistic scientists. Folks are mostly kind of agnostic if you pin them down. And in fact, what these surveys show is that the religious views of people are pretty much independent of anything they do, with the exception of being a professor of religion. I mean, there are some exceptions. Okay, now I'm going to embarrass this distinguished gentleman that I just met at breakfast this morning. And this is John Sumpter, who's going to speak tomorrow, I understand. Yeah. And is it, you know, you always wonder whether this stuff is really true. When on your own, is tectonics really your thing, or is it something that used to be your thing and isn't anymore?
I don't really do tectonics now.
Okay. Yeah, well, anyway, he's Princeton professor, member of the National Academy of Sciences, and I honestly don't remember where I got this, but it was some description of you, John.
it's
both interesting and humorous. And maybe that these first few words are just my summary of whatever I read. Vaguely aware of spiritual needs, began attending services in Princeton Chapel, then reading the Bible and other Christian books. He eventually committed himself to Christ and had his first real experience of Christian fellowship in Taiwan, where he was on a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship. And when I use this this transparency, I say, you know, he had to go all the way to Taiwan to find some Christians. But I have spoken to the faculty Christian group at National Taiwan University, and it is a dynamic group. There is no question about it. So I have some sense of what he was talking about. And then he says, now I'm going to quote directly. I hope this quotation is correct. And John says, if you know scientists, the kinds of problems they have in their lives, pride, selfish ambition, jealousy, that's exactly the thing Jesus talked about in which he came to resolve. Science is full of people with very strong egos who get into conflicts with one another. And he'll tell you much more tomorrow. Charlie Towns, some of you may know, I have a long history with Charlie Towns. He was the provost at MIT when I was a student there. It won't surprise you that I didn't meet him. But when he came to Berkeley, we were there together for 18 years, and Charlie was, and still is, a real gentleman. At Berkeley, a PhD thesis defense requires four faculty members from the department's own department and one from another department. And these things can go on for a while, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours, you know. This is not the sort of thing that people from other departments are very interested in. But, you know, chemistry and physics are right next to each other, and almost all of these outside members came from physics. And it was rumored, and the poor PhD student had to go over there and get the approval. from one of the physics department faculty members to serve on the committee, and it was rumored that a lot of these physics professors had back doors, and when their secretary saw a PhD student from chemistry coming in, they went out the back door, so they wouldn't have to sit on one of these committees. But, you know, Charlie was certainly the most famous scientist at Berkeley, and he did several of these every year, and it was really interesting what he did. To this date, I'm not sure whether Charlie was in conspiracy with the PhD student. But, you know, it'd be going along, the student's suffering, you know, it doesn't look good, and then Charlie asks this question that's impossible to answer. And the student gives the brilliant answer, and we pass it, you know. And I honestly really should ask Charlie what, I never, you know, I didn't want to accuse him of that. But you do wonder, you know, that's just the typical sort of guy he is. Anyway, Charlie has written his biography called Making Waves. That's clever if you're a laser person. Lasers are wave-like phenomena. And he says this. He says, you may well ask just where does God come into this. Perhaps my account may give you some answer, but to me that's almost a pointless question. If you believe in God at all, there's no particular where. He's always there, everywhere. He's in all these things. Be God. First of all, and omnipresent, a great source of strength, made an enormous difference to me. And I and many others were pleased when Charlie Towns got the Templeton Prize a year and a half ago, I guess it was. Arthur Schawlow was a faculty member at Stanford when I was a student there. He was much beloved. Arthur is, he's gone now. He died a couple years ago.